The season of Advent is a season of preparation, anticipation, waiting, but it's a growing season, right? As Christmas gets closer, the anticipation grows, the joy grows, the signs that the Lord is coming get more and more prominent. So it's right that we get a growing sense of joyful hope. You might see, if you're walking around here in the property or even here in the chapel, little specks of gold stars, little gold circles from our celebrations of our 50th anniversary. Even in my house on the steps and even upstairs, I don't know how the gold stars are getting everywhere. But I don't mind that, because they're reminders to us of not only of what we celebrated, but it's as if they're anticipating something great to come. Like, when you see signs, you say, oh, well, it's a sign of something greater. In Advent, the classic pattern is we look at a prophecy from Isaiah, and then we see how Jesus is the fulfillment of the prophecy. That's the daily Mass pattern. And sometimes it's quite easy to see how Jesus is the fulfillment of the prophecy, because the prophet Isaiah said that the blind will see and the deaf will hear, and then we read about Jesus curing a deaf man or something like that. Or the prophecy says there will be a great delicious banquet on the mountain, and then we read about Jesus multiplying the loaves, providing abundant food on the mountain. But sometimes it's not so obvious, and I think today is one of those cases. The gospel is a little bit unusual, so let's start there. It's short, but it has three distinct parts to it. One is this description of John the Baptist as the greatest and the least. And then the second part is this mysterious description of the kingdom being taken by violence. And then the last part, John is Elijah, if you are willing to accept it. So each of these three takes a little pondering. Let's start with this idea of John being the greatest of all those born of women, which is everybody. There isn't anybody alive or who has ever been alive who wasn't born of a woman. So that means everybody. John is the greatest person ever born. It's quite a lofty description or a high praise. Jesus is lifting up John the Baptist as the greatest. Then he immediately says, yet the least in the kingdom of heaven is greater than he. So John is the least. He's lower than the lowest of those in the kingdom of heaven. So it's a very radical transition from greatest to lowest. And Jesus is doing two things here. First of all, he's honoring John the Baptist as the greatest of the prophets. The culmination of the age of preparation, the age of prophecy. But he's also pointing to a huge transition from that age to the new age, in which the prophecies are nothing by comparison to the fulfillment. Which is why John himself says, I'm not worthy to even hold the sandals of the one who's coming after me. Don't look at me, John said over and over again. Look to the one who's coming, that is Jesus. So John is great, yes. But by comparison to Jesus, nobody's great. Or we're all great in him. Everyone who shares the life of God through Jesus Christ is great, including all of us. Now, part of what's going on here, when Jesus says this, John is in prison. I don't know how long he was in prison. In Matthew's gospel, he was arrested around chapter 4. This is chapter 11. When we get to chapter 14, we hear the story of how John gets beheaded, martyred. So this is in between his arrest and his martyrdom. John's in prison, which I think helps us understand the second part of this gospel, where Jesus says, from the days of John the Baptist until now, the kingdom of heaven suffers violence. Well, the days of John the Baptist, I suppose means his public ministry, because once he's arrested, he's no longer doing public ministry, but he's still alive, and the kingdom of heaven is suffering violence. I think what Jesus is referring to here is the violence done against John, because he's in jail. He's the greatest of the prophets, and he's being persecuted. It's happening right now. The violent are taking it by force. There are lots of different ways of interpreting this, but I just am focusing on John, since it's the focus of most of this gospel is on John. Well, John suffered violence. John suffered injustice. He's in jail. He shouldn't be. When Jesus says, this is what's happening, it's as if he's saying, don't get disturbed when you see what looks like the defeat of the plan of God. So you can imagine the apostles and the crowd saying, well, if John can be arrested, well then, and he's obviously a great prophet. Some people even thought he was the Messiah. But if he gets arrested, well, it's as if God's plan can be crushed easily by some petty king, some king like King Herod, who's no great man. And Jesus is saying, no, don't misinterpret what's happening. Don't think that persecution or trials or problems in the church or problems in your own life, don't think that that means the defeat of the plan of God. It's part of the plan of God. God knows what he's doing. And in the case of John, John became a witness and a forerunner to the persecution and crucifixion of Jesus, which also looks like the defeat of the plan of God. It looks like God's messengers, God's own son, being killed. It looks like God has no power over political forces. No. Don't get distracted by the moment of the persecution or the moment of the trial. Look to the bigger picture and see how God uses even these terrible times for his victory. So by saying the kingdom of God suffers violence, he's not saying that the world is more powerful than heaven. He's saying this is part of what happens. And I think it applies to our own life. We all have problems. There's problems in the government. There's problems in society. Problems in families, in parishes, in communities. And it can be very discouraging when we look at what looks like evil conquering the good. I think Jesus is saying, no, don't think that. God is still in charge, and he's still at work. And then he points to John again. All the prophets and the law prophesied up to the time of John. Then he says this puzzling thing. This is the third point of the gospel. If you are willing to accept that he is Elijah, the one who is to come. It's a funny thing to say, isn't it? If you're willing to accept that he's Elijah, if you're not willing to accept that, then he's not Elijah? It's a conditional statement. If you accept that he's Elijah. Elijah, remember, was the great prophet who was not, he was persecuted, but he was not killed. He was taken up. And the expectation of the Jews was he would come again in preparation for the coming of the Messiah. That Elijah would come again. And so they're waiting for the appearance of Elijah. What Jesus is saying here is John is fulfilling that expectation. John, he's not Elijah, literally, but he's fulfilling the role of Elijah. He's filled with the spirit of Elijah. So if you're willing to accept it, meaning if you're willing to accept how the plan of God for Elijah's return is going to be fulfilled, then you can see that if this is actually happening. If you don't have faith, if you don't trust in the ways of God, well, then you're going to miss it. And then it's not Elijah, he's just some guy in prison. You see how different things look if we're viewing them from with the eyes of faith, or if we're just viewing them from our human perspective. Okay, so this is it's a little bit difficult gospel, not obvious, but let's go back to the prophecy that was chosen by the church to go with this gospel. And we see it's a prophecy about big transitions. The first part addresses the people of Israel as a worm. O worm, Jacob, O maggot, Israel. In other words, you're so you're so helpless and weak, you could get squashed. Fear not, O worm. You worm. Now, I don't know how that sounds in Hebrew. It sounds pretty bad to us. Maybe it's doesn't sound as bad, but it's clearly a designation of somebody who's weak and helpless and maybe not even very appealing. And then the Lord says, I will help you. Fear not, I will help you. The Redeemer is the Holy One of Israel. I'm the one who's going to solve this insurmountable problem. It's another case of, you could say, the Israelites, since they were in exile in Babylon at this time, they were in exile, they were suffering, and they probably felt like worms, like God wasn't doing anything to help them, they're in exile. And here, the prophet, the Lord through the prophet says, no, I'm going to help you, and it will be my power at work overcoming the violence that's being done against the kingdom. He says, I'm going to make you a threshing sledge, sharp, new, double-edged. Now, we're not, I don't know if any of us knows what a threshing sledge is, but it's obviously a very powerful tool because he says he's going to use it to thresh the mountains, cut down mountains. This is a fulfillment of the prophecy, right? When the Messiah comes, fill in the valleys, lower the mountains. This is lowering the mountains. And how is he going to do it? He's going to use the worm. You, people of Israel, the lowly ones, I'm going to use you to overcome the powerful enemy. You see the transition? From lowliness to greatness. From worm to powerful instrument in the hands of God. Then the second part of the prophecy says something similar, but with different imagery. It's this transition from desert to orchard, from wasteland to fertile garden. He says, okay, I'm going to turn the desert or the dry ground or the wasteland into a place full of cedar trees and olive trees and pine trees. And everybody will see that the hand of God has done this. So it's a transition from helplessness, hopelessness, weakness, caught in sin, caught in oppression, to being victorious and resplendent and luxurious. It's a complete transition. So this prophecy, now I don't know what it would mean to the people who heard it, the people of Israel, but when we are reflecting on the ministry of Jesus and what he says about John the Baptist and himself, we see, well, this has actually happened. This has happened. The era of darkness, the era of desert experience has been overcome. As great as John was, he was living in a time of darkness. And the light has come. So we don't have to worry about the reign of darkness anymore. So for our Advent journey, for our application to ourselves, we have been given not only the promise of a great future, but the beginning of it has already started because the Lord has already come. Now, he will come again and finish the job, right? There are still many examples of darkness in our world and in our own lives. But we live with confident hope. We live in joyful anticipation of the complete victory of God. That's the Advent journey. We don't see it, but we know it's coming. We might feel oppression, or we might be suffering terribly. We might feel like the kingdom of heaven is being overcome by violence or corruption or sickness or poverty. That's part of our experience. But we know, because God is faithful, that is not the whole picture. We know that a complete and glorious victory is to come. And that's what sustains us in our pilgrimage.